rubbish for years, ever since he was a little doctor in Woodbrook, Kitchen Hill. So I see him yesterday, and he say, Eddowes. That is how he does always call me, you know. Eddowes, he say, come and have a drink. Well, when I work and I don't like drinking because it does keep you back. But he nearly dragged me off the cart, man. In the end, I had the drink with him. He tell me all his troubles. There were also stories of rich women waiting for him behind rubbish tins. Women begging Eddowes to take away their rubbish. But you should have seen Eddowes on those days when the scavengers struck. As I have told you already, these scavengers were proud people and stood for no nonsense from anybody. They knew they had power. They could make Port of Spain stink in 24 hours if they struck. On these important days, Eddowes would walk slowly and thoughtfully up and down Miguel Street. He looked grim then, and fierce, and he wouldn't speak to a soul. He wore a red scarf and a toothbrush with a red handle on these days. Sometimes we went to Woodford Square to the strike meeting to gaze at these exciting people. It amazed me to see Eddowes singing. The songs were violent, but Eddowes looked so sad. Hat told me, it have detectives here, you know. They taking down every word Eddowes and them saying. It was easy to recognize the detectives. They were wearing a sort of plain-clothed uniform. Brown hats, white shirts, and brown trousers. They were writing in big notebooks with red pencils. And Eddowes didn't look scared. We all knew that Eddowes wasn't a man to be played with. You couldn't blame Eddowes then for being proud. One day, Eddowes brought home a pair of shoes and showed it to us in a quiet way, as though he wasn't really interested whether we looked at the shoes or not. He said, brushing his teeth and looking away from us, got these shoes today from the Labas, the dump, you know? They was just lying there and I picked them up. We whistled. The shoes were practically new. The things people just throw away, Eddowes said. And he added, this is a hell of a sort of job, you know? You could get anything if you really look. I know a man who get a whole bed the other day. And when I was picking up some rubbish from St. Clair the other day, this stupid woman rush out, begging me to come inside. She say she was going to give me a radio. Boy, he said, you mean these rich people does just throw away things like that? Eddowes laughed and looked away, pitying our simplicity. The news about Eddowes and the shoes traveled round the street pretty quickly. My mother was annoyed. She said, you see what sort of thing life is. Here I is, working my finger to the bone. Nobody flinging me a pair of shoes just like that, you know. And there you got that thin-ass little man doing next to nothing. And look at all the things he does get. Eddowes presently began getting more things. He brought home a bedstead. He brought home dozens of cups and saucers only slightly cracked. Lengths and lengths of wood. All sorts of bolts and screws, and sometimes even money. Eddowes said, I was talking to one of the old boys today. He tell me the thing is to never throw away shoes. Always look in shoes that people throw away, and you go find all sort of thing. The time came when we couldn't say if Eddowes was prouder of his job or of his collection of junk. He spent half an hour a day unloading the junk from his cart. And if anybody wanted a few nails or a little piece of corrugated iron, the first person they asked was Eddowes. He made a tremendous fuss when people asked him, though I feel he was pleased. He would say, I working hard all day, getting all these materials and them, and people think they could just come running over and say, give me this, give me that. In time, the street referred to Eddowes' collection of junk as Eddowes' materials. One day, after he opened his school, Titus Hoyt was telling us that he had to spend a lot of money to buy books. He said, It can cost me at least $60. Eddowes asked, How much book you getting for that? Titus Hoyt said, Oh, about 7 or 8. Eddowes laughed in a scornful way. Eddowes said, I could get a whole handful for you for about 12 cents. Why you want to go and spend so much money on 8 books for? Eddowes sold a lot of books. Hat bought 20 cents worth of book. It just shows how Titus Hoyt was making everybody educated. And there was this business about pictures. Eddowes said one day, Today I pick up 2 nice pictures. 2 nice sceneries, done frame and everything. I went home and I said, Ma, Eddowes say he could sell us some sceneries for 12 cents. My mother behaved in an unexpected way. She wiped her hand on her dress and came outside. Eddowes brought the sceneries over. He said, The glass a little dirty, but you could always clean that. But they is nice sceneries. They were engravings of ships in stormy seas. I could see my mother almost ready to cry from joy. She repeated, I always, always want to have some nice sceneries. Then pointing at me, she said to Eddowes, This boy father was always painting sceneries, you know. Eddowes looked properly impressed. He asked, Scenery's nice as this? My mother didn't reply. After a little talk, my mother paid Eddowes 10 cents. And if Eddowes had something that nobody wanted to buy, he always went to my Uncle Baku, who was ready to buy anything. He used to say, You never know when these things could come in handy. Hat began saying, I think all this material's getting on Eddowes' mind, you know. It have some men like that. I wasn't worried until Eddowes came to me one day and said, You ever think of collecting old bus ticket? The idea had never crossed my mind. Eddowes said, Look, there's something for a little boy like you to start with. For every 1,000 you collect, I could give you a penny. I said, Why you want bus ticket? He laughed as though I were a fool. I didn't collect any bus tickets, but I noticed a lot of other boys doing so. Eddowes had told them that for every 100 they collected, they got a free ride. Hat said, Is to start getting worried when he begin collecting pins. But something happened that made Eddowes sober as a judge again. He said one day, I in trouble. Hat said, Don't tell us that is thief you been thief and all this materials in them. Eddowes shook his head. He said, A girl making baby for me. Hat said, You sure is for you? Eddowes said, She say so? It was hard to see why this should get Eddowes so worried. Hat said, But don't be stupid, man. Is the sort of thing that does happen to anybody? But Eddowes refused to be consoled. He collected his junk in a listless way. Then he stopped altogether. Hat said, Eddowes behaving as though he invent the idea of making baby. Hat asked again, You sure this baby is for you and not for nobody else? It have some woman making a living this way, you know. Eddowes said, Is true she have other baby, but I in trouble. Hat said, She is like Laura. Eddowes said, Nah, Laura does only have 1 baby for 1 man. This girl does have 2, 3. Hat said, Look, you mustn't worry. You don't know is your baby. Wait and see. Wait and see. Eddowes said sadly, She say, if I don't take the baby, she can make me lose my job. We gasped. Eddowes said, She know lots of people. She say she can make them take me away from St. Clair and put me in Dry River, where the people so damn poor they don't throw away nothing. I said, You mean you're not going to find any materials there? Eddowes nodded, and we understood. Hat said. The Calypsonian was right, you hear? Man centipede bad, woman centipede more than bad. I know the sort of woman. She have a lot of baby. Take the baby by the fathers and get the fathers to pay money. By the time she 30, 35, she getting so much money from so much man, and she ain't got no baby to look after and no responsibility. I know the thing. Boy, he said, don't worry, Eddowes. Wait and see if it is your baby. Wait and see. Hat said, boy, ain't you too damn small to be meddling with talk like this? The months dragged by. One day, Eddowes announced, she dropped the baby yesterday. Hat said, boy or girl?
Girl.
We felt very sorry for Eddowes. Hat asked, you think it's yours?
Yes.
You bringing it home?
In about a year or so.
Then you ain't got nothing now to worry about. If is your child, bring she home, man. And you're still going round St. Clair getting your materials.
Eddowes agreed, but he didn't look any happier.
Hat gave the baby a nickname long before she arrived in Miguel Street. He called her Pleasure, and that was how she was called until she became a big girl. The baby's mother brought Pleasure one night, but she didn't stay long. And Eddowes' stock rose when we saw how beautiful the mother was. She was a wild, Spanish-looking woman. But one glance at Pleasure made us know that she couldn't be Eddowes' baby. Boy began whistling the calypso. Chinese children calling me daddy. I black like jet. My wife like ta baby. And still, Chinese children calling me daddy. Oh God, somebody putting milk in my coffee. Hat gave Boy a pinch, and Hat said to Eddowes, she's a good-looking child, Eddowes, like you.
Eddowes said, you think so, Hat?
Hat said, yes, man. I think she could grow up to be a sweet girl, just as how she father is a sweet man. I said, you have a nice daughter, Eddowes.
The baby was asleep, and pink, and beautiful.
Errol said, I could wait 16 years until she come big enough. Eddowes by this time was smiling, and for no reason at all was bursting out into laughter. Hat said, shut up, Eddowes. You go wake the baby up. And Eddowes asked, you really think she take after me, Hat?
Hat said,
yes, ma'am. I think you do right, you know, Eddowes. If I wasn't so careful myself, and if I did have children outside, I would have bring them all home, put them down. Bring them all home and put them down, man. Nothing to shame about.
Eddowes said, Hat, it have a birdcage. I pick up long time now. Tomorrow, I could bring it for you.
Hat said, is a long, long time now I want a good birdcage. And in no time at all, Eddowes became the old Eddowes we knew. Proud of his job, his junk, and now proud, too, of Pleasure. She became the street baby, and all the women, Mrs. Morgan, Mrs. Baku, Laura, and my mother, helped to look after her. And if there was anyone in Miguel Street who wanted to laugh, he kept his mouth shut when Pleasure got the first prize in the Cow and Gate baby competition, and her picture came out in the papers.
12. Love, 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 alone. About 9 o'clock one morning, a hearse and a motor car stopped outside Miss Hilton's house. A man and a woman got out of the car. They were both middle-aged and dressed in black. While the man whispered to the two men in the hearse, the woman was crying in a controlled and respectable way. So I suppose Miss Hilton got the swiftest and most private funeral in Miguel Street. It was nothing like the funeral we had for the other old widow, Miss Ricot, the MBE and social worker, who lived in a nicer part of the street. At the funeral, I counted 79 cars and a bicycle. The man and the woman returned at midday, and there was a bonfire in the yard. Mattresses and pillows and sheets and blankets were burned. Then all the windows of the gray wooden house were thrown open, a thing I had never seen before. At the end of the week, a sign was nailed on the mango tree. For sale. Nobody in the street knew Miss Hilton. While she lived, her front gate was always padlocked, and no one ever saw her leave or saw anybody go in. So even if you wanted to, you couldn't feel sorry and say that you missed Miss Hilton. When I think of her house, I see just two colors, gray and green. The green of the mango tree, the gray of the house, and the gray of the high galvanized iron fence that prevented you from getting at the mangoes. If your cricket ball fell in Miss Hilton's yard, you never got it back. It wasn't the mango season when Miss Hilton died, but we got back about 10 or 12 of our cricket balls. We were prepared to dislike the new people even before they came. I think we were a little worried. Already we had one man who kept on complaining about us to the police. He complained that we played cricket on the pavement, and if we weren't playing cricket, he complained that we were making too much noise anyway. Sergeant Charles would come and say, "Boys, the super send me. That blasted man ring up again. Take it a little easier." One afternoon when I came back from school, Hat said, "Is a man and a woman. She pretty, pretty, but he ugly like hell, man. Portuguese, they look like." I didn't see much. The front gate was open, but the windows were shut again. I heard a dog barking in an angry way. One thing was settled pretty quickly. Whoever these people were, they would never be the sort to ring up the police and say we were making noise and disturbing their sleep. A lot of noise came from the house that night. The radio was going full blast until midnight when Trinidad Radio closed down. The dog was barking and the man was shouting. I didn't hear the woman. There was a great peace next morning. I waited until I saw the woman before going to school. Boy said, "You know, Hat, I think I see that woman somewhere else. I see she when I was delivering milk up Mukarapa way." This lady didn't fit in with the rest of us in Miguel Street. She was too well-dressed. She was a little too pretty and a little too refined. And it was funny to see how she tried to jostle with the other women at Mary's shop, trying to get scarce things like flour and rice. I thought Boye was right. It was easier to see this woman hopping about in shorts in the garden of one of those nice Mukarapo houses, with a uniformed servant fussing around in the background. After the first few days, I began to see more of the man. He was tall and thin. His face was ugly and had pink blotches. Hat said, "God, he is a first-class drinking man, you hear?" It took me some time to realize that the tall man was drunk practically all the time. He gave off a sickening smell of bad rum, and I was afraid of him. Whenever I saw him, I crossed the road. If his wife, or whoever she was, dressed better than any woman in the street, he dressed worse than any of us. He was even dirtier than George. He never appeared to do any work. I asked Hat, "How a pretty nice woman like that come to get mixed up with a man like that?" Hat said, "Boy, you wouldn't understand. If I tell you, you wouldn't believe me." Then I saw the dog. It looked as big as a ram goat and as vicious as a bull. It had the same sort of thin face its master had. I used to see them together. Hat said, "If that dog ever get away, it gonna have big trouble here in the street." A few days later, Hat said, "You know, it just strike me. I ain't see those people bringing any furnitures at all. It look like all they have is that radio." Edo said, You'd have a lot of things I could sell them.
I used to think of the man and the dog and the woman in that house, and I felt sorry and afraid for the woman. I liked her, too, for the way she went about trying to make out that everything was all right for her, trying to make out that she was just another woman in the street, with nothing odd for people to notice. Then the beatings began. The woman used to run out screaming. We would hear the terrible dog barking, and we would hear the man shouting and cursing and using language so coarse that we were all shocked. Had said to the bigger men, "It's easy to put two and two and see what happened in there." And Edward and Eddowes laughed. I said, "What happened in Hat?" Hat laughed. He said, "You too small to know, boy. Wait until you in long pants." So, I thought the worst. The woman behaved as though she had suddenly lost all shame. She ran crying to anybody in the street, saying, "Help me! Help me! He will kill me if he catches me!" One day, she rushed to our house. She didn't make any apology for coming unexpectedly or anything like that. She was too wild and frightened even to cry. I never saw my mother so anxious to help anyone. She gave the woman tea and biscuits. The woman said, "I can't understand what has come over Tony these days. But it is only in the nights he is like this, you know. He is so kind in the mornings. But about midday, something happens, and he just goes mad." At first, my mother was being excessively refined with the woman, bringing out all her fancy words and fancy pronunciations, pronouncing comfortable as comfortable, and making war rhyme with bar, and promising that everything was definitely going to be all right. Normally, my mother referred to males as man, but with this woman, she began speaking about the ways of men's and them, citing my dead father as a typical example. My mother said, "The onliest thing with this boy, father, was that it was the other way round. Whenever I uses to go to the room where he was, he uses to jump out of the bed and run away bawling, run away screaming." But after the woman had come to us about three or four times, my mother relapsed into her normal self and began treating the woman as though she were like Laura or like Mrs. Baku. My mother would say, "Now, tell me, Mrs. Herrera, why you don't leave this good-for-nothing man?" Mrs. Herrera said, "It is a stupid thing to say to you or anybody else, but I like Tony. I love him." My mother said, "It's a damn funny sort of love." Mrs. Herrera began to speak about Tony as though he were a little boy she liked. She said, "He has many good qualities, you know. His heart is in the right place, really." My mother said, "I wouldn't know about heart, but what I know is that he want a good clout on his backside to make him see sense. How you could let a man like that disgrace you so?" Mrs. Herrera said, "No, I know Tony. I looked after him when he was sick. It is the war, you know. He was a sailor, and they torpedoed him twice." My mother said, "They should have tried again." "You mustn't talk like this," Mrs. Herrera said. My mother said, "Look, I just talking my mind, you hear? You come here asking me advice." "I didn't ask for advice. You come here asking me for help, and I just trying to help you, that's all." "I don't want your help or advice," Mrs. Herrera said. My mother remained calm. She said, "All right, then. Go back to the great man. It's my own fault, you hear? Meddling in white people business. You know what the Calypso say. Is love, love, love alone that caused King Edward to leave the throne. Well, let me tell you. You're not King Edward, you hear? Go back to your great love." Mrs. Herrera would be out of the door, saying, "I hope I never come back here again." But next evening, she would be back. One day, my mother said, "Mrs. Herrera, Everybody afraid that dog you have there. That thing too wild to be in a place like this.
Mrs. Herrera said, It isn't my dog. It's Tony's. Not even I can touch it.
We despised Tony.
Hat said, It's a good thing for a man to beat his woman every now and then, but this man does do it like exercise, man.
And he was also despised because he couldn't carry his liquor. People used to find him sleeping in all sorts of places, dead drunk. He made a few attempts to get friendly with us, making us feel uncomfortable more than anything else. He used to say, Hello there, boys. And that appeared to be all the conversation he could make. And when Hat and the other big men tried to talk to him, as a kindness, I felt that Tony wasn't really listening. He would get up and walk away from us suddenly, without a word, when somebody was in the middle of a sentence. Hat said,
It's a good thing, too. I feel that if I look at him long enough, I go vomit.
You see what a dirty thing a white skin does be sometimes? And in truth, he had a nasty skin. It was yellow and pink and white, with brown and black spots. The skin above his left eye had a raw, pink look of scalded flesh. But the strange thing I noticed was that if you just looked at Tony's hands and saw how thin and wrinkled they were, you felt sorry for him, not disgusted. But I looked at his hands only when I was with Hat and the rest. I suppose Mrs. Herrera saw only his hands. Hat said, I wonder how long this thing will last. Mrs. Herrera obviously intended it to last a long time. She and my mother became good friends after all, and I used to hear Mrs. Herrera talking about her plans. She said one day she wanted some furniture, and I think she did get some in. But most of the time she talked about Tony, and from the way she talked, anybody would believe that Tony was just an ordinary man. She said, Tony is thinking about leaving Trinidad. We could start a hotel in Barbados. Or, as soon as Tony gets well again, we will go for a long cruise. And again, Tony is really a disciplined man, you know. Great willpower, really. We'll be all right when he gets his strength back. Tony still behaved as though he didn't know about all these plans for himself. He refused to settle down. He got wilder and more unpleasant. Hat said, He behaving like some of those uncultured people from John John, like he forget that latrines make for some purpose. And that wasn't all. He appeared to develop an extraordinary dislike for the human race. One look at a perfect stranger was enough to start Tony cursing. Hat said, We have to do something about Tony. I was there the evening they beat him up. For a long time afterwards, the beating up was on Hat's mind. It was a terrible thing, really. Hat and the rest of them were not angry, and Tony himself wasn't angry. He wasn't anything. He made no effort to return the blows, and the blows he got made no impression on him. He didn't look frightened. He didn't cry. He didn't plead. He just stood up and took it. He wasn't being brave. Hat said, He just too damn drunk. In the end, Hat was angry with himself. He said, Is taking advantage. We shouldn't a do it. The man ain't our feelings, that's all. And from the way Mrs. Herrera talked, it was clear that she didn't know what had happened. Hat said, That's a relief anyway. And through all these weeks, one question was always uppermost in our minds. How did a woman like Mrs. Herrera get mixed up with Tony? Hat said he knew, but he wanted to know who Mrs. Herrera was, and so did we all. Even my mother wondered aloud about this. Boye had an idea. He said, Ha!
You know the advertisements people just put out when their wife or their husband leave them?
Hat said,
Boy, you know you're getting too damn big, too damn fast. How the hell a little boy like you know about a thing like that?
Boy took this as a compliment.
Hat said, How you know anyway that Mrs. Herrera leaves your husband? How you know that she ain't married to Tony?
Boy said, I telling you, Hat, I used to see that woman up Mukarapo way when I was delivering milk. I telling you so, man.
Hat said, White people don't do that sort of thing. Put an advertisement in the paper and thing like that.
Eddowes said, You ain't know what you talking about, Hat? How much white people you know?
In the end, Hat promised to read the paper more carefully. Then, big trouble started. Mrs. Herrera ran out of her house screaming one day.
He's going mad! He's going mad, I tell you! He will kill me this time, sure!
She told my mother.
He grabbed a knife and began chasing me. He was saying, I will kill you. I will kill you. Talking in a very quiet way.
You do him something?
My mother asked.
Mrs. Herrera shook her head.
She said, It is the first time he threatened to kill me, and he was serious, I tell you.
Up till then, Mrs. Herrera hadn't been crying, but now she broke down and cried like a girl.
She was saying, Tony has forgotten all I did for him. He has forgotten how I took care of him when he was sick. Tell me, you think that's right? I did everything for him. Everything. I gave up everything. Money and family, all for him. Tell me, is it right for him to treat me like this? Oh, God, what did I do to deserve all this?
And so she wept and talked and wept. We left her to herself for some time. Then my mother said,
Tony looked like the sort of man who could kill easy, without feeling that he really murdering.
You want to sleep here tonight? You could sleep on the boy bed. He could sleep on the floor.
Mrs. Herrera wasn't listening. My mother shook her and repeated her offer.
Mrs. Herrera said, I am all right now, really. I will go back and talk to Tony. I think I did something to offend him. I must go back and find out what it is.
Well, I really give up, my mother said. I think you've taken this love business a little too far, you hear?
So Mrs. Herrera went back to her house. My mother and I waited for a long time, waiting for a scream. But we heard nothing. And the next morning, Mrs. Herrera was composed and refined as ever. But day by day, you could see her losing her freshness and saddening her beauty. Her face was getting lined. Her eyes were red and swollen, and the dark patches under them were ugly to look at.
Hat jumped up and said, I know it! I know it! I know it a long time now!
He showed us the personal column in the classified advertisements. 7 people had decided to leave their spouses. We followed Hat's finger and read,
I, Henry Hubert Christiani, declare that my wife, Angela Mary Christiani, is no longer under my care and protection, and I am not responsible for any debt or debts contracted by her.
Boye said, Is the self-same woman?
Eddowes said,
Yes, Christiani, doctor fellow. Know him good. Used to pick up rubbish for him.
Hat said, Now I ask you, why? Why a woman want to leave a man like that for this Tony?
Eddowes said,
Yes, know Christiani good. Good house, nice car, full of money, you know. It have a long time now I see him. Know him from the days when I used to work Mukarapo way.
And in about half an hour, the news had spread through Miguel Street. my mother said to Mrs. Herrera. You better call the police. Mrs. Herrera said,
No, no, not the police.
My mother said,
Like you afraid police more than you afraid Tony.
Mrs. Herrera said,
The scandal.
Scandal hell, my mother said.
Your life in trouble, and you thinking about scandal?
Like if this man ain't disgrace you enough already.
My mother said,
Why you don't go back to your husband?
She said it as though she expected Mrs. Herrera to jump up in surprise. But Mrs. Herrera remained very calm. She said,
I don't feel anything about him. And I just can't stand that clean doctor smell he has. It chokes me.
I understood her perfectly and tried to get my mother's eye. Tony was growing really wild. He used to sit on his front steps with a half bottle of rum in his hand. The dog was with him. He appeared to have lost touch with the word completely. He seemed to be without feeling. It was hard enough to imagine Mrs. Herrera or Mrs. Christiani in love with him. But it was impossible to imagine him being in love with anybody. I thought he was like an animal, like his dog. One morning, Mrs. Herrera came over and said, very calmly, I have decided to leave Tony. She was so calm, I could see my mother getting worried. My mother said, What happened now? Mrs. Herrera said,
Nothing.
Last night, he made the dog jump at me. He didn't look as if he knew what he was doing. He didn't laugh or anything. I think he is going mad. And if I don't get out, I think he will kill me. My mother said,
Who are you going back to?
My husband.
Even after what he print in the papers? Mrs. Herrera said,
Henry is like a boy, you know, and he thinks he can frighten me. If I go back today, he will be glad to have me back.
And saying that, she looked different. And hard. My mother said,
Don't be so sure.
He know Tony.
Mrs. Herrera laughed in a crazy sort of way.
Tony was Henry's friend, not mine. Henry brought him home one day. Tony was sick like anything. Henry was like that, you know. I never met a man who liked doing good work so much as Henry. He was all for good works and sanitation.
My mother said,
You know, Mrs. Herrera, I really wish she was like me.
If somebody did marry you off when you was 15, we wouldn't have been hearing all this nonsense, you hear?
Making all this damn fuss about your heart and love and all that rubbish.
Mrs. Herrera began to cry. My mother said,
Look, I didn't want to make you cry like this. I'm sorry.
Mrs. Herrera sobbed.
No, it isn't you. It isn't you.
My mother looked disappointed. We watched Mrs. Herrera cry. Mrs. Herrera said,
I have left about a week's food with Tony.
My mother said,
Tony is a big man. You mustn't worry about him.
He made terrible noises when he discovered that she had left him. He bayed like a dog. And bawled like a baby. Then he got drunk. Not drunk in the ordinary fashion. It got to the stage where the rum was keeping him going. He forgot all about the dog, and it starved for days. He stumbled drunk and crying from house to house, looking for Mrs. Herrera. And when he got back, he took it out on the dog. We used to hear the dog yelping and growling. In the end, even the dog turned on him. Somehow it managed to get itself free, and it rushed at Tony. Tony was shocked into sense. The dog ran out of the house, and Tony ran after it. Tony squatted and whistled. The dog stopped, pricked up its ears, and turned round to look. It was funny, seeing this drunk, crazy man smiling and whistling at his dog, trying to get him back. The dog stood still, staring at Tony. Its tail wagged twice, then fell. Tony got up and began walking towards the dog. The dog turned and ran. We saw him sprawling on a mattress in one of the rooms. The room was perfectly empty, nothing but the mattress and the empty rum bottles and the cigarette ends. He was drunk and sleeping, and his face was strangely reposed. The thin and wrinkled hands looked so frail and sad. Another for sale sign was nailed to the mango tree. A man with about 5 little children bought the house. From time to time, Tony came around to terrify the new people. He would ask for money, for rum, and he had the habit of asking for the radio. He would say, "You have Angela's radio there. I charge and rent for that, you know. $2 a month. Give me $2 now." The new owner was a small man, and he was afraid of Tony. He never answered. Tony would look at us and laugh and say, "You know about Angela's radio, eh, boys? You know about the radio. Now, what is man playing at?" Hat said, "Who will tell me why they ever have people like Tony in this world?" After 2 or 3 months, he stopped coming to Miguel Street. I saw Tony many years later. I was traveling to Arima, and just near the quarry at Laventil, I saw him driving a lorry. He was smoking a cigarette. That and his thin arms are all I remember. And riding to Kerenage one Sunday morning, I passed the Christiani's house, which I had avoided for a long time. Mrs. Christiani, or Mrs. Herrera, was in shorts. She was reading the paper in an easy chair in the garden. Through the open doors of the house, I saw a uniformed servant laying the table for lunch. There was a black car, a new big car, in the garage. 13. The Mechanical Genius. My Uncle Baku was very nearly a mechanical genius. I cannot remember a time when he was not the owner of a motor vehicle of some sort. I don't think he always approved of the manufacturer's designs, however, for he was always pulling engines to bits. Titus Hoyt said that this was also a habit of the Eskimos. It was something he had got out of a geography book. If I try to think of Baku, I never see his face. I can see only the soles of his feet as he worms his way under a car. I was worried when Baku was under a car because it looked so easy for the car to slip off the jack and fall on him. One day it did. He gave a faint groan that reached the ears of only his wife. She bawled, "Oh, God!" and burst into tears right away. "I know something wrong. Something happened to he." Mrs. Baku always used this pronoun when she spoke of her husband. She hurried to the side of the yard and heard Baku groaning. "Man," she whispered, "you all right?" He groaned a little more loudly. He said, "How the hell I all right? You mean you so blind you ain't see the whole motor car break up my ass?" Mrs. Baku, dutiful wife, began to cry afresh. She beat on the galvanized iron fence. "Hat," Mrs. Baku called. "Hat, come quick. A whole motor car fall on he." Hat was cleaning out the cow pen. When he heard Mrs. Baku, he laughed. "You know what I always to say," Hat said. "When you play the arse, you're bound to catch hell. The blasted car brand new. What the hell he was tinkering with so?"
"He say the crankshaft wasn't working nice."
"And is there he looking for the crankshaft?"
"Hat,"
Baku shouted from under the car,
"the moment you get this car from off me, I going to break up your tail."
"Man," Mrs. Baku said to her husband, "how you so advantageous? The man come round with his good, good mind to help you, and now you want to beat him up?"
Hat began to look hurt and misunderstood. Hat said,
"It ain't nothing new.
is just what I expect. It's just what I always get for interfering in other people's business. You know I'm mad to leave you and your husband here and go back to the cow pen.
No, Hat. You mustn't mind he. Think what you would say if a whole big new motor car fall on you.
Hat said, all right, all right. I have to go and get some of the boys. We heard Hat shouting in the street.
Boy and Errol!
No answer.
Boy and Errol!
Coming, Hat.
Where the hell you boys been, eh? You think you was man now and you could just stick your hands in your pocket and walk out like man? You was smoking, eh?
Smoking, Hat? But what happened now? You turned deaf all of a sudden? Was boy he was smoking, Hat?
Is a lie, Hat? Was Errol really? I just standing up watching him.
Somebody make you policeman now, eh?
Is cut ass for both of you. Errol, go cut a whip for boy. Boy, go cut a whip for Errol.
We heard the boys whimpering. From under the car, Baku called.
Hat, why you don't leave the boys alone?
You go bless them bad one of these days, you know. And then they go lose you in jail.
Why you don't leave the boys alone? They big now.
Hat shouted back.
You mind your own business, you hear? Otherwise, I leave you under that car until you rotten, you hear?
Mrs. Baku said to her husband,
take it easy, man.
But it was nothing serious after all. The jack had slipped, but the axle rested on a pile of wooden blocks, pinning Baku to ground without injuring him. When Baku came out, he looked at his clothes. These were a pair of khaki trousers and a sleeveless vest, both black and stiff with engine grease. Baku said to his wife, they rarely dirty now, eh? She regarded her husband with pride. Yes, man, she said, they rarely dirty. Baku smiled. Hat said, look, I just sick of lifting up motor car from off you. You hear? If you want my advice, you better send for a proper mechanic. Baku wasn't listening. He said to his wife, the crankshaft was all right. It's something else. Mrs. Baku said, well, you must eat first. She looked at Hat and said, he don't eat when he working on the car unless I remind he.
Hat said, what do you want me do with that? Write it down with a pencil on a piece of paper and send it to the papers?
I wanted to watch Baku working on the car that evening, so I said to him, Uncle Baku, your clothes looking really dirty and greasy. I wonder how you could bear to wear them. He turned and smiled at me.
What you expect, boy? He said. Mechanic people like me ain't have time for clean clothes.
What happened to the car, Uncle Baku? I asked. He didn't reply.
The tappet knocking?
I suggested. One thing Baku had taught me about cars was that tappets were always knocking. Give Baku any car in the world, and the first thing he would tell you about it was, the tappet knocking, you know? Hear? Hear it? The tappet knocking? I asked. He came right up to me and asked eagerly, what? You hear it knocking? And before I had time to say, well, something did knocking, Mrs. Baku pulled him away, saying, come and eat now, man. God, you get your clothes really dirty today. The car that fell on Baku wasn't really a new car, although Baku boasted that it very nearly was.
It only do 200 miles, he used to say.
Hat said,
well, I know Trinidad's small, but I didn't know it was so small.
I remember the day it was bought. It was a Saturday. And that morning, Mrs. Baku came to my mother, and they talked about the cost of rice and flour and the black market. As she was leaving, Mrs. Baku said, he gone to town today. He say he got to buy a new car. So we waited for the new car. Midday came, but Baku didn't. Hat said, 2-1 that man taking down the engine right this minute. About 4 o'clock, we heard a banging and a clattering, and looking down Miguel Street towards Dockside, we saw the car. It was a blue Chevrolet, one of the 1939 models. It looked rich and new. We began to wave and cheer, and I saw Baku waving his left hand. We danced into the road in front of Baku's house, waving and cheering. The car came nearer, and Hat said, "Jump, boys! Run for your life! Like he get mad!" It was a near thing. The car just raced past the house, and we stopped cheering. Hat said, "The car out of control. You'll have an accident if something don't happen quick." Mrs. Baku laughed. "What do you think it is at all?" she said. But we raced after the car, crying after Baku. He wasn't waving with his left hand. He was trying to warn people off. By a miracle, it stopped just before Arapita Avenue. Baku said, "I did mashing down the brakes since I turned Miguel Street, but the brakes ain't working. It's a funny thing. I overhauled the brakes just this morning." Hat said, "It have two things for you to do. Overhaul your head or haul your ass away before you get people in trouble." Baku said, "You boys gonna have to give me a hand to push the car back home." As we were pushing it past the house of Morgan, the pyrotechnicist, Mrs. Morgan shouted, "Ah, Mrs. Baku, I see you buy a new car today, man." Mrs. Baku didn't reply. Mrs. Morgan said, "Ah, Mrs. Baku, you think your husband could give me a ride in his new car?" Mrs. Baku said, "Yes, he could give you a ride, but first your husband must give me a ride on his donkey cart when he buy it." Baku said to Mrs. Baku, "Why you don't shut your mouth up?" Mrs. Baku said, "But how you want me to shut my mouth up? He was my husband, and I have to stand up for you." Baku said very sternly, "You only stand up for me when I tell you, you hear?" We left the car in front of Baku's house, and we left Mrs. and Mrs. Baku to their quarrel. It wasn't a very interesting one. Mrs. Baku kept on claiming her right to stand up for her husband, and Mr. Baku kept on rejecting the claim. In the end, Baku had to beat his wife. This wasn't as easy as it sounds. If you want to get a proper picture of Mrs. Baku, you must consider a pear as a scale model. Mrs. Baku had so much flesh, in fact, that when she held her arms at her sides, they looked like marks of parentheses. And as for her quarreling voice, Hat used to say, "It sounded as though it coming from a gramophone record, turning fast, fast backwards." For a long time, I think Baku experimented with rods for beating his wife, and I wouldn't swear that it wasn't Hat who suggested a cricket bat. But whoever suggested it, a second-hand cricket bat was bought from one of the groundsmen at the Queen's Park Oval and oiled and used on Mrs. Baku. Hat said, "Is the only thing she really could feel, I think." The strangest thing about this was that Mrs. Baku herself kept the bat clean and well-oiled. Boyi tried many times to borrow the bat, but Mrs. Baku never lent it. So on the evening of the day when the car fell on Baku, I went to see him at work. "What you did saying about the tap and knocking?" he said. "I didn't say nothing," I said. "I was asking you." "Oh." Baku worked late into the night, taking down the engine. He worked all the next day, Sunday, and all Sunday night. On Monday morning, the mechanic came. Mrs. Baku told my mother, "The company send the mechanic man. The trouble with these Trinidad mechanics is that they is just piss and tail little boys who don't know the first thing about cars and things." I went round to Baku's house and saw the mechanic with his head inside the bonnet. Baku was sitting on the running board, rubbing grease over everything the mechanic handed him. He looked so happy dipping his fingers in the grease that I asked, "Let me rub some grease, Uncle Baku."
"Go away, boy, you too small."
I sat and watched him. he said. The tappet was knocking, but I fix it. I said,
good.
The mechanic was cursing. I asked Baku, how the points? He said, I have to check them up. I got up and walked around the car and sat on the running board next to Baku. I looked at him and I said,
you know something?
What? When I did hear the engine on Saturday, I didn't think it was beating nice. Baku said, you getting to be a real smart man, you know? You learning fast. I said, is what you teach me. It was, as a matter of fact, pretty nearly the limit of my knowledge. The knocking tappet, the points, the beat of the engine, and, yes, I had forgotten one thing.
You know Uncle Baku?
I said. What, boy?
Uncle Baku? I think is the carburetor.
You really think so, boy?
I sure, Uncle Baku.
Well, I can tell you, boy, is the first thing I asked the mechanic. He don't think so. The mechanic lifted a dirty and angry face from the engine and said, when you have all sort of ignorant people messing about with the engine the white people build with their own hands, what the hell else you expect? Baku winked at me. He said, I think is the carburetor. Of all the drills, I liked the carburetor drill the best. Sometimes Baku raced the engine while I put my palm over the carburetor and off again. Baku never told me why we did this, and I never asked. Sometimes we had to siphon petrol from the tank, and I would pour this petrol into the carburetor while Baku raced the engine. I often asked him to let me race the engine, but he wouldn't agree. One day, the engine caught fire, but I jumped away in time. The fire didn't last. Baku came out of the car and looked at the engine in a puzzled way. I thought he was annoyed with it, and I was prepared to see him dismantle it there and then. That was the last time we did that drill with the carburetor. At last, the mechanic tested the engine and the brakes and said, look, the car good now, you hear? It cost me more work than if I was to build over a new car. Leave the damn thing alone. After the mechanic left, Baku and I walked very thoughtfully 2 or 3 times around the car. Baku was stroking his chin, not talking to me. Suddenly, he jumped into the driver's seat and pressed the horn button a few times. He said, what do you think about the horn, boy? I said,
blow it again. Let me hear.
He pressed the button again. Hat pushed his head through a window and shouted,
Baku, keep the damn car quiet, you hear, man? You making the place sound as though it have a wedding going on.
We ignored Hat. I said,
Uncle Baku, I don't think the horn blowing nice.
He said, you really don't think so? I made a face and spat. So we began to work on the horn. When we were finished, there was a bit of flex wound round the steering column. Baku looked at me and said, you see, you could just take this wire now and touch it on any part of the metalwork and the horn blow. It looked unlikely, but it did work. I said,
Uncle Buck, how you know about all these things?
He said, you just keep on learning all the time. The men in the street didn't like Baku because they considered him a nuisance. But I liked him for the same reason that I liked Popo, the carpenter. For thinking about it now, Baku was also an artist. He interfered with motor cars for the joy of the thing, and he never seemed worried about money. But his wife was worried. She, like my mother, thought that she was born to be a clever handler of money, born to make money sprout from nothing at all. She talked over the matter with my mother one day. My mother said, Taxi making a lot of money these days, taking Americans and their girlfriends all over the place. So Mrs. Baku made her husband buy a lorry. This lorry was really the pride of Miguel Street. It was a big new Bedford, and we all turned out to welcome it when Baku brought it home for the first time. Even Hat was impressed.
If it's one thing the English people could build,